Welcome to the New Books Network.
One of life's terrible truths is that the price of love is grief. Eventually, we all lose people we love, and the hole they leave behind can be an overwhelming abyss with pain that rivals any physical injury imaginable. In this age of COVID-19, we are surrounded by grief. We're surrounded by grief and by loss at every turn. Today's guest knows intimately the terrible dimensions of grief and will share with us his creative, compassionate, and life-affirming response to it. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Please subscribe to our series on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm happy to warmly welcome Jay Garfinkel to the show today to talk about his new book, Heirlooms, Memory and Cherished Objects. Jay Garfinkel is a fine arts photographer, television producer, and writer. Over a 40-year career, he produced thousands of hours of animation, reality TV, and documentaries. He currently focuses on still life and landscape photography. Jay Garfinkel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Your book started out as a photo exhibit, and the book itself is a beautiful object of art. What was the idea behind the project?
Well, the idea was that when a person passes, they leave behind objects. Everyone in their lifetime will collect thousands of objects, whether it be trivial things like ashtrays, glasses, pens. Not so trivial, of course, if you need the pen or the ashtray. And cars, items of clothing. And when the person ceases to be, the survivors are left with a horrible task of having to decide what to do with it. Many times, those objects are given away to charities, to friends and family who can use them. At the end of the day, though, when everything has been given away, as was in the case of my own son's belongings, in comes the junk man and sweeps away all of the material life, the things that were the objects of that person's life, they cease to be. And what you have is an empty room, which leaves me and leaves the people that I've met in the course of doing this book with a very unsettling feeling. When my son died, I collected just a few personal objects and put them in three suitcases and brought them home with me. And on the way, I thought to myself, what am I doing with these suitcases? If I had given it away to the junk man, what difference would it be than putting it in my storage vault? I'll never see it again. And I was inspired by the idea, just because I am a visual artist, to take those things that were most meaningful to me personally, and photograph them. Then I could feel comfortable in never seeing them again in a storage bin, because those very personal photographs would be there for me to see, look at, and to and have the connection of memory to my son. And that's what led to this idea of memory and cherished objects, the idea that there is an emotional connection between memory and the object. And a photograph very often, at least in my case, sparks that emotional connection.
Your son was not a victim of terror or any violence. In fact, he had suffered from several chronic health problems for years, which were expected to continue to be chronic, so that when he died of heart failure, that came suddenly and unexpectedly. How did you get to One Family, an organization that supports families of people murdered in terror attacks?
Well, that's a very good and interesting story. I do think that there is a connection between someone who dies unexpectedly, for example, in my son's case, or someone who dies in a car crash, or any other kind of accident where they suddenly die, and between victims of terrorism. What is similar is that it's completely unexpected, and that it's being unexpected that it goes beyond sadness. You know, we're all going to lose somebody in our lifetime. Usually it's a parent, and we're sad, but it's not unexpected. When it becomes unexpected, for example, when you say to a loved one, have a nice day, and the other one says back to you, yeah, love you, see you later, and they get on a bus, a city bus, for example, in Israel, and they die in a terrorist attack, that is an overwhelming experience because it is so totally unexpected. A friend of mine who had seen my artwork said to me, why don't you go visit the folks over at One Family? They deal with people who've died in terror. And I thought, well, my son didn't die in terror. And do I really want to open myself up to more families who experience grief? And I was very reluctant, but I did. And I met with the CEO, Mark Belzberg, who, after chatting for a while, said to me that I'm suffering from what many people suffer from who've lost somebody and who are grieving in a very profound way from wearing a griever's mask. And I could never get comfortable wearing that mask. And I asked him, what is that mask? And he said, a mask is when you're, after some time of grieving, you're in a public space and there are other people around you. If you're happy, people say, well, you know, he's gotten over it. And if you're unhappy, people say he'll never get over it. And you could be unhappy or happy for no reason other than the fact that, like any other person, there are events that make you happy or unhappy, nothing to do with the death of anyone. And that feeling of being looked at and being judged for your emotions and people taking your emotional temperature was unnerving. And he said, come to work or volunteer. I didn't ever work, but I volunteered for us. Meet some of our families because it's a place where you can take your griever's mask off. You can be who you are and you won't be judged. And I was skeptical at first if I wanted to do it, but I decided, you know, I don't want to stay in the space that I'm in, which was a very uncomfortable space. And I decided to throw my hat in and see what I could do to help other people. And I did.
So would you say that for some people, grief support groups can be very helpful?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big believer in grief support groups. I think that you need to be with people who are in the same boat you are. First of all, you can get great advice from people like that. They've had the experience over a long period of time. If you're just starting on the road to grief and you're inexperienced, you don't know what to make of your emotions, and they can be a useful guide. So sure, I think it's a great thing.
So tell us about your own experience of the difference between depression, grief, and sadness.
Yeah, it's a very good question, Renee. We're all sad for one reason or another, and it passes. And we're sad for a specific reason. In the case of someone who dies, you know, a parent, you're sad. And yet, at the end of the day, you're going to get over it because the sadness passes. In depression, it's over no particular reason, at least in my experience of depression. You're not depressed for any, you don't focus on anything in particular. You don't keep telling yourself the same obsessive story all the time. You're just depressed. In grief, that's a whole different kettle of fish. In grief, you know why you have grief. You have obsessive thoughts about the person. You can't get out of it. It's like a blanket that covers you with darkness. And no matter how hard you try, you can't escape it. And it comes over you intermittently. Sometimes you feel great, and then for no particular reason, you start thinking about the person, and this darkness comes over you. Or you see the objects that you inherited, and that sets off a whole range of emotions, all of them not good.
So you met with and spoke with bereaved parents who lost a child in a terror attack, whose child was murdered. And you worked with them to pick an object that was meaningful to them. Tell us about that process.
Yeah, Mark and Chantel Belsberg at One Family suggested that I go throughout the whole of Israel, from north to south, east to west, in every kind of neighborhood with very diverse populations. So I really wasn't dealing with one kind of family, whether religious or non-religious. We had a whole mixed bag. We had Christians and Druze and Jews and religious and I thought it was a very useful thing for me. I'd only been here for 7 years and knew the part of Jerusalem that I lived in, and I knew something about the families. But I'd never been in the home of many Israelis, at least the diverse population of Israelis. So it was a very interesting experience. Also, none of the families spoke English, which was, in a way, I had to understand it from their language point of view. They spoke in Hebrew, and I took my notes in English, and I had a translator with me for those times that I was stuck. Although I pretty much understood everything, to have people express themselves in the language that they were familiar with, and as you know, language is very much connected to culture, and the death of a child. And I only met people who lost a son or a daughter. Interestingly, the ranges of ages were also from 10 years old, which was the youngest, to 35 years old. So it was a population where I learned something about Israeli life and also about grieving, and they were very much connected. The families, when I first met with them, I would sit down with them, and they wanted to know, without asking me, my bona fides. Why should they open themselves up to me? And I opened myself up to them very, very early on in these conversations. I always took an iPad with me with pictures of my son and pictures of the artwork that I had done, and very much the pictures that started this project. And it was only after that, when they could feel that they could trust me, that they opened themselves up telling me their story. And their stories were different. I found that there was no common denominator of how people handled their grief, which was sort of interesting. People handled it in all sorts of different ways, ways that I wouldn't have done it, but certainly it seemed to have comforted them.
And so you spoke with the bereaved parents. Did you get any insight into the experience of siblings whose brother or sister were violently murdered?
I did. And what people don't normally know about terrorist attacks is when the headlines go away, it's over for the public. This was a bad and terrible act. Tragedy, and everybody's just, let's move on to the next headline, the next soundbite. But for the families, it doesn't go away. not only doesn't it go away, it affects siblings in the family, and they take on, in many ways, the grief of their parents without getting the attention for it. You know, when someone dies in a terror attack in Israel, the newspapers, television, the cameras are all over it, talking to the families, trying to figure out what happened, the trial. First of all, you have to catch the person, and then there's the police hunt. So there's headlines all the time. Then there's the trial, and then there's what's going to happen to the person who killed their family member. Throughout that whole process of newspaper and television circus around a family, these siblings, these children, many times ages 8, 9, 10, even teenagers, have to go to school. And in a school situation, they have friends who have seen the television reports and have read the newspapers, and it's discussed in the families. So they're sort of outsiders being discussed, and it's extremely hard on family members. And one of the good things about One Family is that they recognize that early on, and they have camps to help, in many cases, teenagers and post-teenagers stay together for weekend retreats or sometimes a week or two retreat, so that they're all together with people who are like them, who understand what they've been through.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Murder cries out for justice. And you spoke about the manhunt that follows terror attacks, and police follow every murder that even is not in a terrorist context. But what happens to the families when the murderer is found and convicted, and sometimes not found? What is the impact of justice on the families?
Oh, I think it's extremely, from in my reading of the families and my meeting with the families, it occurs many times where the perpetrator is not brought to justice. Where they can't be found, or they've escaped to Syria or to Turkey or to Jordan, so they leave the jurisdiction of the place where they committed the terror attack, or they're protected by the Palestinian Authority, and it's hard to find them. So in those cases, the anger, I would say, but also the hurt of the family goes on much longer than when the person is brought to justice. When sentencing comes, families are always in the courtroom demanding that a strict sentence or a long sentence for the perpetrators. I think one of the most depressing, from my point of view, scenes here in Israel is when a person is brought to justice, and they're put into prison, and then because Israel does a deal with either Hamas or usually Hamas, to exchange prisoners. In the case of, there was an Israeli soldier who was captured by Hamas in the 2014 war. 1,000 terror prisoners were let go. And these, not all of them, but 360 of them had blood on their hands. That means they'd killed somebody in a terror attack. It was so profoundly affecting these families. Couldn't understand why, for the sake of one person, that the hundreds that were killed had to be let go. And I thought that was and Israel doesn't do it as much anymore. It's had a political effect on Israel's being able to do that. I think in a good way.
Now, your book is visually arresting and moving. We are audio, so our listeners will have to buy the book to see the photographs. But tell us about one particular photograph that's in the book that you like. I'm sure you like them all, but one that's very powerful.
I think that the among the powerful images in the book was the murder of Rivka Holzberg. And many of our listeners here will remember the Mumbai massacre. There was a movie made about it. And these were a group of terrorists from Pakistan who made their way into India, to Bombay, and decided to shoot up innocent people in a hotel, in the Mumbai Hotel, a classic five-star hotel. Along the way, they separated, a group separated from the main terror group, and they made their way to the Chabad Lubavitch hotel, I guess you could call it, but it was more of a place, a gathering place for many people to come, a community center, they decided to kill everybody in the building. They succeeded in killing Rivka Holzberg and her husband, Gavriel, who ran the center. They were Israelis from Afula in the northern part of Israel, and they had gone to India as part of their mission. Their two-year-old child survived the attack, Moshe, and was saved by his Indian nanny, who understood what was going on and grabbed the child before he could be shot and took him to safety. In the course of this terror attack, which killed 178 people, the terrorist shot Rivka in the neck and broke the necklace she was wearing. That necklace was given to her by her parents on her wedding day. The parents put an ad telling people, you know, this is broken. How do we fix it? And the designer stepped forward and said, I'll do it. And she fixed it. And when they came to the meaningful object, that they wanted me, the cherished object they wanted me to photograph, they handed me this necklace. And I didn't really know what to do with it. It was a necklace, and it looked like many necklaces. It was not ordinary, but not extraordinary either. And I thought to myself, what's missing in this picture is the emotional connection between the person who gave the necklace, and now it's back with them. So I asked her father if he would hold the necklace. And he did, and it's a defiant pose, and it's a wonderful, stark image that needs to be seen. One of the things that I learned about in doing this project is not every object of memory has to have a pleasant memory associated with it. The memory associated with this necklace is not a pleasant memory. Nor was it a pleasant memory for the family. but it was an important memory. The necklace will be given to when Moshe, who's now 13, when he one day marries, will be given to his bride as her wedding present. So there is a heirloom quality to it, a continuity of passing something from one generation to the next generation. And at the same time, a certain sense of sadness at the loss.
Well, you spoke with 33 families. Do you have a sense of what characterized families who, in your judgment, seem to be coping best?
I think the ones that cope best are the ones that join the One Family programs. The One Family has extensive programs for family members. They have psychological services. I think the ones that do not fare well are the ones who sort of say it'll all work itself out in the end, and it hardly ever does. But the ones who do are the ones who take their children into therapy, which I think because at the end of the day, when a terror attack happens, there's a tremendous change in the relationships within the family. And sometimes it's for the better, and many times it's not for the better, it's for the worse. And tension and anger grow in the family, and unless resolved or mediated by someone on the outside, the families do not do well. So I think that those families that use this intervention do very well. I found that many of the mothers who lost children, and because they told me this, it wasn't an observation necessarily, they told me, and I did observe these craft classes, working with one's hands and creating something new. And I thought that it was really good that they're involved in it. And, you know, there are two campuses for One Family, one in Jerusalem and one in Renana. And both of them have extensive craft programs for mothers who've lost children. So I think those, and I think that the third one are those who involve themselves in helping others. You know, I found two kinds of folks. One kind of family, they sort of became more insulated. And it's very hard to be with people who've lost a child. If you obsess about it all the time, you sort of become a social pariah. Because if that's all you can talk about, people say, well, yeah, okay, I really would rather not be with you socially. And they sort of put themselves in a very bad place socially. They're very isolated socially. But those who do very well, it appeared to me, are those people who get engaged with helping other people. And I found that quite a bit. A lot of projects that they were involved in, a lot of social projects, a lot of helping other people's projects. Those families did well.
What role, if any, did faith or religion play in the healing of some of the families you met?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me just take one example of a Druze family. Druze are Arabs, but they're not Muslims. They live in the northern part of Israel. It's a community that's very patriotic to the country. Very religious, conservative religious values. I visited several Druze families, but one stands out. His daughter was killed coming home from school. She was 13 years old, getting ready to get onto the school bus. Someone put an IED to kill as many children as possible near the bus stand, and she was killed. When I met with the father, Yosef, he said to me that, first of all, the context is The Druze religion is one that most people don't know about because they don't tell people about it. The elders know all the tenets of the religion and pass along to people what they need to know. But outsiders like myself really don't know the tenets of the religion, except for the fact that everybody knows that Druze believe that the soul comes back to earth in the form of another person. And he said to me that he prays every day that his daughter will find a home and a family that loves her as much as they did. And it seemed to be a man at peace. He appeared to be very peaceful with it, as did his wife. So I think that that was a very profound religious experience for me, experiencing someone else's religious passion. I don't know that I'm as committed to the soul coming back and forth as he was, but it was nice to experience it from someone who was religious. I found many Jews, especially the more observant, who thought it was God's will and his will be done, and they accepted without understanding why this all happened. So I did see that as well.
And finally, what advice can you give to listeners who will be called upon and will want to comfort bereaved friends and family members in this terrible time of illness and death?
I would say that there are three things that you should not do. And when confronting someone who's lost a child to it, or anyone really, in a tragedy, there are three things that you really shouldn't say. The first thing is, there's a reason for everything. The second thing that I think that is most hurtful is, he's in a better place. And finally, I would never say to someone, I know how you feel. You have absolutely no idea how I feel. And saying that, I felt was sort of condescending. Why say these things? But for those people who have suffered a loss, I would say that there are several things that I've learned from them, and if I'd like to pass along, which was that time does not heal grief, but in the space of time, you learn how to handle those feelings. And so grief becomes less scary. And I think the second thing that people who've experienced grief for the first time is that there's a lot of anger that occurs. And people are angry at everything and everyone. And it's very difficult on the surviving spouse or surviving children. And that relationships change. Many things that were bad in the relationship get worse, but I've also seen relationships reset and they get better. And it's a very difficult process, but in the end, I think we all learn in our own way that there is no right or wrong way to handle this, but you find your equilibrium on your own.
Well, thank you. Those are wise words, hard-won wisdom. Jay, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming on the show today and for your powerful and important book, Heirlooms, Memory, and Cherished Objects.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov. ¶¶